Alrighty, off to a good start. Let's go to 1 Peter. Let's see what he has to say to us. We have made our way through the first chapter here, and we're going to progress on into chapter 2. Let me grab my clicker. So we've dealt with the first chapter, and so we're going to move on to chapter 2, as I mentioned. Here in the text, if we go to verse 1 of chapter 2, this is what Peter has to say to us. He exhorts us, so put away all malice and deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander. Like newborn infants, long for the pure spiritual milk, that you may grow up into salvation, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is good. As you come to him, a living stone, rejected by men, but in the sight of God chosen and precious. You yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Okay, so as you conclude chapter 1, what's the call at the end of chapter 1? He's calling us to be holy, right? To live holy lives, to strive to be more and more like Jesus, to rid ourselves of anything that is impure, anything that is sinful, to put those desires aside and to make your purpose one that is holy before God and before men. And so he kind of concludes all of those thoughts in verse 1. He starts off by saying we should put away what? He mentions several different ideas here, concepts. First he says malice, and then he mentions deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and then slander. So these four concepts here, and he identifies them with what three-letter word? All, right? All. He says all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, all slander. Right? You've got to get rid of those things in your life. And think of the word malice. What's the idea that we're trying, do you think Peter is trying to drive at here? Okay, it's spiteful, vicious kind of language or attitudes. What'd you say?
Angry.
But it's more than just anger. Malice is having evil thoughts about someone else, wanting someone else to be harmed. You're thinking maliciously about an individual. So you've gone beyond anger to now, what are we thinking? It's hate. Yes. Yes. So you're actually wishing for bad things to happen to people. Now, as a Christian, we know that should be completely foreign to us, but is it always? You have somebody at work that you just don't get along well with? Could you fall into the trap of malicious, evil thoughts? Yeah. And now that they've got the promotion, you know what? I hope they fall flat on their... Because I knew they were going to fall. I knew they weren't ready for that position. That should have been me. Am I way off base here?
No.
He says get rid of malice. And this is more than just action. This gets into the heart. Right? This is intention. He says, all deceit. Okay, you think about malice, thinking ill of people, wanting ill for people. And then he goes a step further and he says, now, you need to get rid of all deceit, hypocrisy, and envy. Isn't it kind of odd how he put those three together? Why? So he says all malice, and he leaves it by itself. And then at the end, he says all slander, and he leaves it by itself. But for these three, he brings them together. Why do you think that is? Deceit, hypocrisy, and envy. Okay, so they're all around this ideal of distrust or dishonesty. Envy is kind of the opposite of malice, isn't it? Envy's the idea that I want your life. Yeah. But envy is, you have what I want. I should have that. And how do people get what they want enviously? What's the other word that we use? What's in the Ten Commandments? What's the word used there?
Covet,
right? You covet. You envy. And when you envy something, what do? Sometimes you use deceit to get it. And you definitely are a hypocrite, aren't you? The word hypocrite's an interesting word. It's from the word we get actor from. Hypocrisy carries the idea of you're playing a part. Right? You're acting a way to deceive. When you think about it religiously, you know, hypocrisy, the hypocrite seems religious, but in reality, they're anything but. They're, as Jesus says, you're like whitewashed tombs. On the outside, you're all nice, but inside, you're just full of dead men's bones. He says, you need to get rid of deceit and hypocrisy and envy. And in all of those things, even with malice, those are all about what? They're all about somebody else. It's all about you reflecting on someone else. It has nothing to do with you in doing self-inspection and looking at how am I struggling? Where should I be stronger? How can I grow? It is ultimately about us. You're right. But what I'm saying, from our perspective, we're taking everything and putting it on to somebody else. Yes, I agree. These are all problems with us. But it's us trying to deflect onto someone else. And so is slander, isn't it? When we talk about the word slander, does that have a close cousin? Anybody know the close cousin of slander? Gossip, right? Yeah. It's funny that he bookends this list with malice on the front and slander on the back. You know, when you slander somebody, you know, that has a legal definition. You can sue for slander. And what is that idea? What does it mean to slander? Well, let me ask it this way. This might be better. What's the difference between slander and gossip? Yeah. Yeah. And in gossip, you may be just simply sharing information. It may even be true information, but you don't have the right to share it. That's gossip. But slander is when you take and you're using deception to tear. You've taken malice and now you're acting on your malice with your words. And so, you know, again, all these ideas here have this idea of you getting outside of yourself and trying to destroy someone else in order for you to feel some kind of way. Well, Peter says you have to get rid of those things. And instead, verse 2, he says you need to be like a newborn infant in this way. A newborn infant is has a couple of drives in life, don't they? Life as a newborn infant is somewhat simple in that you want three things, don't you? What three things does any newborn infant want? What'd you say? That's it. They're driven by their those drives, right? And they must have those fulfilled. That's why they cry, right? They want those things. Now, and when a child is hungry, they're going to let you know, aren't they? Now, I have a 9-year-old who lets me know when he's hungry. He when it's dinner time, it's dinner time. When it's lunch time, it's lunch time. When it's snack time, it's snack time. Right? Children, especially infants who their awareness of the world is very, you know, very small. They're driven toward wanting to have that need fulfilled in them. Well, Peter says that we ought to be driven in the same way when it comes to the Word of God. That we ought to be driven to study, to learn, to grow. You ever fight those? Do you ever fight to hold on to that urge? Does your zeal ever wane for Bible study? Not getting a lot of reaction, but I'm assuming there's a lot of head nodding, at least internally, right? Unless you're a much better Bible student than me, sometimes you got to force yourself to do it. Sometimes you have to do that. But Peter says, you know, you ought to have that longing. And then he adds this little note at the end there in verse 3. He says, if indeed you've tasted that the Lord is good. Have you tasted that the Lord is good? And y'all are going to have to start at least going, uh-huh, yeah, well, we're there with you. I'm not getting much tonight. I'm fishing hard. He says that you've tasted the Lord is good. What's your motivation? What drives you? What creates the passion in your heart for knowing God? Well, it's knowing how good He is. We've mentioned this before, but one of the interesting things when you study the book of Judges, you know, after you've gotten through Joshua and they've conquered the land, the promised land, they then have settled now, right? You get to the book of Judges and God begins to appoint judges over the people. But one of the interesting things, if you go to Judges chapter 2 and you look at what the writer has to say about the people, it lets us know there in chapters 1 and 2 that while Joshua was alive, how did the people serve God? They were very faithful. And then it goes on to say that, you know what, that next generation, the ones who grew up while they were conquering the land, they served God. But what happened when they died out? There arose another generation who did not know God. What an amazing thing. They did not serve God because they did not know God. They didn't know about His goodness. They didn't know all of the good things they had done. If you go all the way back to the beginning of Joshua, and I'm trying to tie all this together. After they crossed the Jordan, and this happens twice. So they crossed the Red Sea. What does God have them do when they cross the Red Sea? The memorial stones, right? They do that again when they cross the Jordan. Do you remember why they do that? Because God tells them why. It's not to create an idol. This isn't something you come back to worship as your God. But he tells them why he wants them to do it. Do you remember? He says, so that when your sons see these stones, they will ask you what, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but what do these mean? And then you'll tell them. You'll tell them what? You'll tell them how God brought you out of Egypt, that brought out your ancestors out of Egypt, how he brought them across the Red Sea, how he brought them across the Jordan and into the Promised Land. Because God knows something about us. We must have reminders. We forget all too quickly. Why does God give us a weekly reminder? Do you ever think about that? Why? Every week does he ask us to do this? Is it because he might forget? No. Is it because he really needs us to partake of bread and the fruit of the vine every week? No. He's doing it for us because we need that. Turns, you have something. That's a great point. Because of those stones, what happened to them? Well, anybody pinpoint where those are? Yeah. Yeah. So we can't go back to those stones anymore, but what we do every week is we come together over these to remember what he's done for us. And so Peter says, if you tasted that the Lord is good, what does he mean tasted? Well, it's the idea of you reflecting on what God has done for you. The Lord is good, and he's been so, so very good to each and every one of us. So he goes on. Now, this is interesting. He says, as you come to him, what? This kind of goes to what Turner just mentioned, as a living stone. I don't know exactly. I can guess at what I think he means by this. But before I mention what I think it might be, what do you think he means? Why use this illustration about living stones? What's the point? And why you think about it? I'll just read it so you can have a second to think about it. Maybe. Let me read it, and then you think about it. As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious. You yourselves, like living stones, are what? This is the key. Are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. What are these stones? Roger.
I guess I think of Matthew 16.
Okay. Okay, when he talks about build, I came to build my church. Maybe so. And there may be different. I think it's the temple. Because what's the connection? It's the priesthood, right? And where did the priesthood serve under the law of Moses? Well, in the temple, or tabernacle originally, but later David built his temple. I mean, not David. Solomon built the temple, and then later, of course, it was rebuilt after Zerubbabel brought the people back to the land after the captivity period. And he and Ezra led that rebuild. Well, here he's saying, you're a living stone. Now, that temple was destroyed when? 70 A.D. Now, at the time Peter's writing, if the timing is right, and I think it is, because I think Peter died before the destruction of the temple still exists in Jerusalem. It's still there, and it's almost ready to be complete when he's writing this. But do you remember, if you go back to Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus is there with the apostles, and remember what they said to him? They are showing him, or I don't think it says they said anything, but it describes them showing him the greatness of the temple. And then you remember what Jesus says? There will not be one stone left on top of another that will not be torn down. There for them, in that moment, their reflection about worshiping God centers on the temple that existed in Jerusalem. But very soon, that was not going to be the case, even for the Israelites, even up to this day. There is no temple for them to worship on. All they have is a piece of property where they believe the temple once stood. But you, as a child of God, are a living stone. See, God did rebuild the temple. Did you know that? God rebuilt the temple. It's you. You're one of those stones. You are the spiritual house of God, the living, breathing temple of God. Paul makes that allusion a few times in his own writings. Here Peter is doing it as well. And so he calls us priests. Did you also know that? You are a priest. You're not even Levi. And yet you are a priest. You're a priest under the order of Melchizedek. You're a priest of the Holy God. And because you're a priest, you're able to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God. And you broaden out this idea of spiritual sacrifices. What do you think he means? What are spiritual sacrifices?
Mm-hmm.
Hebrew, well, yeah, so Romans 12, 1 and 2, right, he says that we are to be a living sacrifice, reasonable and acceptable to him. Yeah. Also, Hebrews chapter 13 tells us that our voice, our singing, is a spiritual sacrifice to him. Paul tells the Philippians that their offering was a spiritual sacrifice to God, reasonable and acceptable. Our spiritual sacrifices of worship are, I believe what he's talking about, is when we come together as a group to collectively worship, we're offering spiritual sacrifices. So that's the intro to chapter 2. He's going to go on in chapter 2, verse 6, and he's going to mention some Old Testament quotes for us. He's going to quote from a couple different places. He's going to quote from Isaiah 28, and then again in Psalm 118 and verse 22, and again in Isaiah 8:14. That's those three quotations there. But he says in verse 6, for it stands in the scripture, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone. Remember he's called us living stones? He says, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone, chosen and precious. And whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. See, he's not talking about the temple. He's talking about Jesus being our chief cornerstones. Verse 7, so the honor is for you who believe, but for those who do not believe, the stone that the builders rejected, that's Jesus, has become the cornerstone and a rock of stumbling and a rock of offense. So he changes focus for just a moment from us to those who have rejected Jesus. And he says at the end of verse 8, they stumble because they do what? They disobey the word as they were destined to do. And so we'll come back next week and we'll look at the end here, we'll go on to verse 9. He's going to give us some more descriptors about the church and who we are as his chosen people. So we'll get into that next week. Any other thoughts or questions? Time goes very quick. So I never get as far as I want to, but we'll keep on. So we'll come back to verse 9 and we'll pick up with what Peter has to say.